All right, let's go ahead and open up to John. John 4, probably some of you thought we'd never get into John 4. Well, here we are. We're ready to dive into John 4. So I thought the best way to start is let's just kind of tip our toes into the water of John 4, read through these first passages, and then we're going to have to do a little bit of a history lesson. Of course, it's always good to keep. This is kind of the diagram I came up with for the first five chapters, and here we've just finished the transition from John the Baptist. I guess you could say his much natural water. That was back a few verses before this in chapter 3, and now we're going to move on to Jesus's really living water, and we're going to see him talk living spiritual water. We're going to learn about that in his encounter with the Samaritan woman. So that brings us to the Samaritan woman then, and she's kind of a counter. Remember where we've gone here. The way a chiasm works is the middle one is really the hinge. Everything leads into it and leads out of it. We've already had a testimony. That's John 1, mostly in other people's words. Testimonies about Jesus in other people's words. At the end of chapter 5, kind of the end, I kind of picked off this passage and broke it down in this way. At the end of chapter 5, we're going to have another testimony of Jesus, and it's going to be especially in his own words. And so you see how this whole passage is kind of encapsulated in that. Then in John 2, and at the end of John 4, going into John 5, each of those had two signs. And that indicated that the Messiah was here. The I Am Jehovah God of Israel was coming to dispense grace and mercy to a rebellious and idolatrous nation. God is operating on the basis of his long suffering. How is Israel going to respond? And he gives them these signs, two in chapter 2, and there's going to be two at the one at the very end of chapter 4 and then the beginning of chapter 5. And now we've just finished Nicodemus, this encounter with Nicodemus. Nicodemus was especially a representative of Israel's national salvation and Jerusalem. Remember, everything has to start in Jerusalem. The idea isn't what most of historic Christianity says. If Israel rejects Christ, then go out to Judea and Galilee, and if they reject Christ, then go to Samaria, and if they reject Christ, then go to the whole world. See, that's not the way it works. The idea is Jerusalem has to receive Christ first. If they don't receive him, it's going to shut down the whole program and salvation can't go out to the rest of the world. And of course, we know in God's programs that's why he raised up the Apostle Paul. Israel was cast away in her rebelliousness, and he set her aside, his prophetic program with her, leaving the Gentiles especially absolutely hopeless, and he raised up Paul then to take salvation out to the world through Pauline Grace Mystery Truth to accomplish another purpose, another program with another people. But in Israel's prophetic program, salvation can't go out to the rest of the world until Jerusalem receives Christ. How can he make a great nation Israel without Jerusalem? I mean, it's impossible. The way it's supposed to work is Jerusalem. This is what he was explaining to Nicodemus. Jerusalem is supposed to receive, believe and receive Christ. Then Jerusalem would go to Judea and they would believe and receive Christ. Judea would go to Galilee. They'd believe and receive Christ. Then Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem would go to Samaria and they'd receive, believe and receive Christ. Then all Israel would be saved. Then he'd make a great nation of Israel, raise her above all other nations of the world, and they'd be the conduit of his salvation, his light, his glory, his blessings to the whole world. That's the way it works. So now when the counter to that, he goes right to the heart of the matter. Jerusalem has to receive him, and he counters that. Now he's going to go to the farthest end of Israel, Samaria, and we're going to have an encounter with a Samaritan woman as a representative. Now Israel's national salvation in the light of the next step being the whole world. Once Jerusalem, Judea and Galilee and Samaria had received Christ, then salvation could go to the whole world. But if they continue to reject, Jerusalem continues to reject, it's going to shut down the whole thing. And that's exactly what happened at the stoning of Stephen in Acts 7. And then shortly after that, the raising up of Paul. So that's where we're at. So let's go ahead and jump into this. And I guess we'll start by just, let's just read through the passage a little. Let's go to chapter 4, verse 1. When therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples. It's interesting here, a few verses before that, John's disciples noticed Jesus' ministry was growing. Now here you have the religious leaders, the Pharisees, and they see that his ministry is growing. So these Pharisees were keeping a close watch on his ministry. And verse 3, he left Judea, so he's going to leave Judea and departed again to Galilee. Remember, we've already been in Galilee, that's John 2, with the sign of the changing of the water to wine at the wedding in Cana. That was up in Galilee. He's come from Galilee to Jerusalem. He's gone from Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Judea, and he's going to now go back to Galilee, but he's going to go through Samaria. And he must needs go through Samaria. Galilee is on the other side of Samaria. The shortest route is just to go north up through Samaria. I was going to throw in a map, but I forgot. But I think everyone can picture that. I guess sometimes Jews would not want to even go through Samaria and would go clear across the Jordan up there around Samaria and come up into Galilee without going through it. But the shortest route was through Samaria, and that's the way Jesus is going to go. And it says, notice it says here, and he must needs go through Samaria. That's another one of those things, kind of like what we talked about last time in John, where he takes you to the very brink, and actually he takes you, pushes you beyond the brink, makes you take one step beyond the brink. He says something like, no one received him. The whole world rejected him. Even his own people rejected him. And then he'll say, you're just over the cliff, you've taken one step too far, like in those old cartoons, you're hanging in air, the next thing is to fall down 40 flights to the canyon, and you're hanging in air, and John grabs him by the scruff of the neck, puts you back on the cliff, and says, but those who did, so there is some who are going to receive him. We saw that last week. Well, here you have another one of John's favorite kind of sayings. And this must needs. It's an indication that it's the will of the Father. We saw this before in chapter 3. Just flip back to verse 14. And we see this example again. And we'll see many more as we continue to go through John. Verse 14 of chapter 3. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So that's a common kind of literary tool John uses that we can watch for as we go through John. It indicates it's not just something he wanted to do. It's the Father's will. There's something bigger going on here that he must needs go through Samaria. And we'll see what that is as we go through the account. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. So here we are. We're back way back in the Old Testament. Remember Jacob after he had the struggle with the man that turned out to be the Lord, and he changed his name from Jacob to Israel. Right after that, Jacob set up an altar. That's the word I'm looking for. An altar, and worshiped the God of Israel. And he set that up to do that. And he bought a parcel of land to do that. This is the parcel of land he's talking about. This is where Jacob came in the land. Then at the end of Genesis, when Jacob is on his deathbed, he gives this land to his son Joseph, and really to Joseph's two sons, and especially Ephraim and Manasseh, but especially Ephraim and his two sons. And that's the land of Joseph's tribe, Ephraim, and Manasseh's tribes. And so here we are at that point. So there's a lot of history on this land. There's a lot of patriarchal history, and we're going to see the Samaritan woman knows about this and knows about this past history of Israel and the founding fathers and the patriarchs. All right, so with that little bit of history, let's go to verse 6. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, here we have a real good indication of Jesus's absolute humanity. He wasn't just pretending. He wasn't just assuming it. He was an actual man, took onto himself actual humanity, and here he's wearied from his journey. If it was sunny, the hot sun, the walking, this area of the country isn't always real fertile, so it might have been very dusty, rocky, that kind of thing. And he sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. And Jesus saith unto her, give me to drink. For the disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. Now remember that verse. It comes right before another verse. One of the things we're going to do in chapter 4, I always do this, is we really need to kind of set aside, just like we did in chapter 3 with Nicodemus, we need to set aside, you don't need to throw it away, you can bring it back later, but for the time being, just set aside what we think we know about this Samaritan woman and this whole encounter in Samaria, all the things we learned starting in Sunday school, all the way through, because we're going to bring out some things tonight that will change perhaps the way we look and have the perspective on the woman here. But just keep that in mind. The disciples were gone away into the city. Notice that's a city in Samaria. It's a Samaritan city. And they went to buy meat to get food. Just keep that in mind. It's going to be important after we read the next verse. Then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, ask drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Now, usually we rush over this. Usually, this woman is pictured kind of pretty negatively as you go through the page, as you go through the encounter, and especially the rivalry between the Jews and the Samaritans. But I think it's interesting. We got to at least take a note here that this woman comes and she says the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Now, the Jews as a whole did consider them, and this kind of brings us back to this purification concept. They would consider them because of the way they worshiped the God in the wrong place, apart from the Davidic monarchy in Jerusalem and the temple and all that, that they were impure. And that's why they didn't have contact with them. But she comes along and she says, for the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. But we just read, in verse 9, we see Jesus has a dealing with a Samaritan woman. So that's not absolutely true what she says. And then let's take it a step further. Now, maybe that's just Jesus. I mean, he's God. He can do anything he wants. But remember the verse I pointed out in verse 8, his disciples were going to a Samaritan city to buy dinner or lunch. I guess this would be lunch at this time. So they had dealings with the Jews. They had no, here you had a bunch of Jewish disciples and they're going to a Samaritan city and they're going to buy food from them. And probably it'll include meat and things like that that aren't necessarily always that can be a little iffy with Jewish consumption. So what she says here, this sets us right off, is what she's saying here isn't absolutely true. We have two indications before she even says the Jews don't have any dealings with the Samaritans. We have two examples of Jews having dealings with Samaritans. The disciples, the Jewish disciples, go to buy meat in a Samaritan city. Jesus goes and interacts with the Samaritan woman asking about water. So there you got food and water. That kind of puts us, she's kind of talking here superficially, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. She's talking a little bit superficially. What she's saying isn't really absolutely true. There's this negative attitude and purity concern, but it doesn't prevent dealings between Jews and Samaritans. And Jesus answered and said unto her, verse 10, if thou knewest the gift of God and who it is that saith to thee, give me to drink, thou would have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. And we'll go ahead and just stop there, because what I want to do is just look at a few things. We have to answer the question, who are the Samaritans? And that's going to be an important question that we need to answer and really get that done. They're going to start a dialogue, and you know what Jesus is going to do? He's going to do the same thing he did to Nathanael, the same thing he did to Mary, the same thing he did to the religious, or tried to do anyway, with the religious leaders in the temple, and the same thing he did with Nicodemus, and the same thing he's going to do with a bunch of other people in the rest of the book of John. He's going to come, he's going to take what her superficial, kind of external, superficial, outer conversation, where she's just kind of saying things that aren't really at least wholly true, as we just saw with no dealings between Jews and the Samaritans, when John's just given us two examples of Jews having dealings with Samaritans. So she's just kind of blabbering. She's just yabbering. And you know what he does? He does what he did with everyone we've met so far. He just takes it and he sweeps it off. He just throws it, just sweeps it away and starts talking about things that have to do not with the superficial outer blabber that people come up with, but he's going to go do exactly what he did with Nathanael and Mary and Nicodemus. He's going to go down, plunge into the depths of the desires of their heart, the greatest desires of their heart, and he's going to address that. He's just going to, everything, all she's blabbing about, just sweep that aside, and he's going to plunge to the depths of her soul. And we're going to see him bring that out, bring her out now. Not the external, outer blabber she's doing, but he's going to go down into the deep internal desires, and it's going to keep progressing as we go through this account. And so that's what he's going to be doing now. But we have to answer the question being, who are the Samaritans? And that's an important question, because most commentators, where they go next is 1 Kings 17. We're not going to go to 1 Kings 17, but that tells us what happened when the nation divided. Maybe this would be a good time, though, to take a look at our timeline. Here's our timeline. Remember, it doesn't include the dispensation of grace. They don't know anything about the dispensation of grace. Jesus isn't talking about the dispensation of grace. He's talking about this. The dispensation of grace isn't in there. Here we are, and he's going to go back now to the division of the nation. And remember, and you see, this is not a good thing about Zoom, but maybe I'm glad, because I'm hoping everyone here knows when the division of the kingdom came in. Because that's from a Leviticus 26, when he breaks the pride of their power. Their nation divides. It's in the second course of punishment. Remember, you had David and Solomon. Remember, Solomon's reign ended where he was basically an apostate king. He had a son, Rehoboam, that took over after him. And the son, and I'm not going into all the history. We're not even going to turn back to this part. I'm just going to summarize it. Rehoboam started increasing the work requirements and taxed the people more. The people in the 10 tribes up north came down and asked him to relieve them of the work and the taxes, and he said no. And so they go back, and the nation starts dividing at that point. And they turns into a northern kingdom. The northern kingdom is called, it's basically three different terms you'll read about in the prophets, and you really need context to know, especially the first one. Sometimes the northern kingdom is called Israel. Now, of course, we think of Israel as the whole nation, but at that time, the northern kingdom was called Israel. The southern kingdom was called Judah. And so sometimes it's divided up that way. Sometimes Judah and Jerusalem and Benjamin are always called Judah and Jerusalem. That is pretty constant. But the northern kingdom is sometimes called Israel. It's sometimes called Ephraim, Joseph's son, and sometimes it's called Ephraim. What was the third thing? Samaria. I should remember that since that's what we're in. So sometimes when you're in the Old Testament, you get any of those three words, you need to determine if he's talking about the northern kingdom, especially with Israel. Israel may apply to the whole nation, in northern and southern kingdom together, or it can apply just to the northern kingdom. But then you'll also see Ephraim and Samaria used too. That's all references to the northern kingdom. Who are the Samaritans? So that begins after Solomon, the nation starts to divide. Solomon's son, Rehoboam's increase of work level and increase on taxes. They divide the ten tribes go back up north, and they're going to set up their own area under Jeroboam. And Jeroboam does all kinds of things, and now we'll pick up there as we go through. This is in 930 BC is when Solomon and then on to Rehoboam and Jeroboam, that division of the nation starts to take place. Now we're going to fast forward it as we look through this history. So in 930 BC, it's the second course of punishment. That's according to Leviticus 26. Then that's the nation is going to start to divide in two now, a northern and southern kingdom. And it's going to be, he's going to resort, Jeroboam is going to establish the golden calf worship up in the northern kingdom. He's going to set up golden calves. You remember back at Israel after the Exodus, the golden calf incident? Well, he starts that worship up in the northern kingdom in Bethel. He's going to put it up there in Bethel and also Samaria. And that's going to lead to the apostasy. This is Jeroboam at the beginning of that split. He sets this all up, the idolatry, the apostasy, golden calves, and it's going to result in their eventual destruction and removal from the land by the Assyrian captivity. The Assyrians are going to come down, and they're going to take the people out and take over the land. And during this time, Samaria is referred to as the capital city. After the Assyrians take over, the whole region will be called Samaria, just to kind of keep some of these things in mind. So it begins, this split begins in about 930 BC and between the northern and southern kingdoms. And Judah was going to stay in Jerusalem and be, for a little while, loyal to the Davidic monarchy and Israel's religious system. Jeroboam up in the north is going to set up idolatry and take the northern kingdom down the wrong path. And then now we're going to fast forward some 300 years. So let's take a look at that. And this we will turn to. The first part of the history is in 1 Kings 17. Now we're going to fast forward at 300 years from there. And we're going to go to 2 Kings 17. So we're 300 years down after that initial split of the kingdom, Jeroboam doing his thing, and the northern kingdom has just been getting worse and worse and worse from then on. So let's go to 2 Kings 17. And one thing I just wanted to show you, if we have a little bit of our timeline here, and maybe it'd be a good idea to go back to it, our timeline here, you can just read through. You can open up to 2 Kings 17 and you can just start reading. You don't need anyone to tell you anything. You can just start reading and have a basic idea of what's going on. You may not understand every detail. You might have to look something up or do something, but you're going to have a basic idea. So here we are. We were at, the nation began to split around the second course of punishment. Now we've gone through, the northern kingdom's gone through the third course of punishment, and they've entered into the fourth course of punishment. That's where we are in 2 Kings, in the fourth course of punishment. The fourth course of punishment includes that Assyrian captivity, and then that's going to lead into the Babylonian captivity, which kicks off the fifth course of punishment. But here we are at the end of the fourth course of punishment with the Assyrian captivity that's going to take away the northern kingdom. That's going to happen first, 722 BC. Then you're going to have the Babylonian captivity that's going to carry away the southern kingdom. And that happens about 120, 130 years later. All right, with that little bit of history, let's just go ahead and read chapter 17. 2 Kings chapter 17. And I'm just going to read through this and just point out some things. We're really heading over here and into verse 27, 26 and 27. But I thought, let's just see. I just want to show you that if you just have this little bit of history, you don't have to get an advanced degree. You don't got to go to get a master's degree at a seminary. You don't have to do any of that. If you just have this little bit of background, you can just read these things. For chapter 17, verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, so that's the king of the southern kingdom, began Hoshea, the son of Elah, to reign in Samaria. Remember, what are the three names for the northern kingdom? Israel, Ephraim, Samaria. So that's the king in the northern kingdom. Over Israel, 9 years. And there it's Samaria and Israel, that northern kingdom. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel that were before him. Verse 3, against him up came Shalmaneser, king of Assyria. So now we have, Assyria is going to start this onslaught. They're going to start working working on the northern kingdom here. And Hoshea became his servant and gave him presents. So he became a tributary, basically paid tribute to Assyria. But he, verse 4, and the king of Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea. So for a number of years, he was given tributes to Assyria to assuage their wrath and all that and not come and destroy him. But then Hoshea does something foolish. Verse 4, Assyria found conspiracy in Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, the king of Egypt, and brought no present to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. So no doubt Hoshea decided, I'm going to send my tributary to Egypt. Maybe Egypt will protect me. Well, Egypt didn't protect him, and here he is in prison, and Assyria imprisons him. Verse 5, then the king of Assyria came up throughout all the land. So here we have the start of the Assyrian onslaught historically. And went up to Samaria and besieged it 3 years. So he's besieging this area for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away into Assyria and placed them in Halah and Habar by the river Gozan and in the cities of the Mede. Now, it's important to realize, so here we have the Assyrian captivity. It's kicking into gear here, and there he's going to come down, and he's going to remove the people of Israel, the northern kingdom, and place them in various Gentile lands around the up around the area. It's important to realize, though, when it says that, it doesn't mean he removed all the people. He took the people. You see the same thing in the Babylonian captivity. He left the poor. He left, maybe it'd be better to explain who he took. He took the ones that showed promise. He took the leaders. He took anyone that had talents, special talents, better than average talents. So if you're the ones there who were literate, like Daniel, and could, especially from a literate standpoint, could read and write and do all that, they would go. So it wasn't that they took all the people. They left the ones that would require care or something, and they took the ones that didn't, probably the more the young and left the old, and things like that. So it's important to realize that when they say he took the people, he took the leadership of the Northern Kingdom, he took those, the businessmen, he took those who were talented, those who could read and write, he took the young, and especially males, he would take them and go and take them into these other lands because they could immediately start contributing. But he left behind a lot of people. It's just they weren't people who could rule, weren't people who could lead. They were poor, maybe uneducated, had elderly, that kind of thing. So it's important to realize he didn't remove all the people. There were people that remained. Verse 7. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord. Now we're going to, this is why I didn't go back to 1 Kings 17, the more ancient history, because he's going to review it here. So I thought we'd just read it here. Verse 7. For so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, which had brought them out of the land of Egypt and under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and feared other gods. So there's their main problem, right? They went into idolatry. Here, the Lord God, Jehovah God of Israel, delivered them out of Egypt, and they went and followed other gods. Verse 8, and walked in the statutes of the heathen. Whose statutes and commandments were they supposed to be walking according to? God's, right? And whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel and the kings of Israel, which they had made. Now, what you got to see here is, notice how many times it's Lord, all caps. This is his I am Jehovah name that he gave them back in Exodus 3. For they were supposed to, out of faith, rely, access his grace through that name. Just fall on the grace resident in that name. That's where God has all his grace for Israel, in that name. Of course, that's an important name in John, too. And it's going to be a really important name when a little further in the encounter with the Samaritan woman. So God keeps doing these things for a rebellious people, delivers them out of Egypt, takes them through the wilderness, conquers their enemies, gives them provisions. The whole time they're rebellious. Now, it's important to remember that according to the law they entered, what God should have done is gone down and consumed them. Instead, he reserved the right to operate outside the law. And he turned that grace resident in his Jehovah name turns the order of the law. The law said, the law didn't tell him to deliver. He didn't tell him to talk to these people, reason with these people, try to persuade them to come back to himself. The law never called for that. The law called, if you're a rebel, you're going to be consumed, put to death. God reserved the right to offer grace and mercy first through his Jehovah name. Then, depending on how they responded to that, would determine whether they get more mercy and grace or they enter into his wrath and judgment. Then what happens is they're going to receive wrath and judgment, not so much because they broke the first commandment, thou shalt not commit idolatry, but because they broke the second commandment. They rejected the grace resident in his name. They took the time of his long suffering when he's dispensing grace through his name, and they use that time to become more rebellious, more idolatrous. He's going to protect his name, and now they get the wrath and judgment for breaking the second commandment. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain. Treat it as though it's not worth anything. Throw it away, and when God makes it available, throw it away. And you're going to go through this account. God keeps doing things graciously. See, the law didn't... Well, let's read some more here, and it'll bring out some of these things. In verse 9, this is what the children of Israel did secretly, those things that were not right against the Lord their God. And they built high places and cities and fenced cities, and they set up to them images and groves in every high hill and under every green tree. All these things, God delivered them, God provided for them, God conquered their enemies, he pushed the enemy out, all these things he did for them. And their response is just to go further into rebelliousness and idolatry. they're rejecting the grace resident in his Jehovah name. They're taking the name of the Lord in vain. And that's going to bring the wrath and judgment. Verse 11, and there they burnt incense in the high places. You know, the whole high place, the concept, the vanity of human thinking, like going on a hill will make you closer to your God. And you can burn incense and it'll kind of give him some aromatherapy. So he's nice and you can manipulate him to do what you want to do. It's just, you know, that whole idolatry is just such a bunch of nonsense, such human wisdom. That's such darkness. Verse 12. Well, let's finish verse 11. As they did before them and wrought wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger, to wrath. And that should immediately, that phrase should bring something to your mind. That phrase is right out of Leviticus 26. Leviticus 26 gives those five courses of punishment, and when he describes one and then he begins the next one. And if for all this grace and mercy I'm dispensing through my Jehovah name, if for all this you still rebel, then I'm going to come at you with the fury of my anger, the fury of my wrath. And that's what Israel's doing here. That's why he's going to bring the Assyrians. For they served idols, verse 12, whereof the Lord had said unto them, ye shall not do this thing. Yet the Lord testified against Israel. See, they served idols. If God went according to the law, the first commandment, he should have gone and consumed them. Instead, he keeps working with them. Let's read the next verse. Yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all the prophets and by all the seers, saying, turn ye from your evil ways and keep my commandments and statutes according to the law, which I commanded your fathers and I sent to you by my servants. That's the grace resident of his Jehovah name, because God, according to the law they contracted with him to operate on at Sinai, the law did not call for God to a bunch of rebellious idolaters to go down and plead with them, or to go send prophets or seers or anything. The law said, go down and consume them. Poof. But God has reserved the right to operate outside the law. And when they deserved, poof, he sent grace and mercy. And they're using the time of this when he's dispensing the grace and mercy through his provision, his I am Jehovah name. I am what you need to become a great nation. I'll do it all for you. And he keeps dispensing, even though they're rebellious. Then they're going to fall into his fury, further wrath. They're going to receive the wrath and judgment, not so much for the idolatry, that's true, the idolatry, but it's because they took the name of the Lord in vain. They treated it as if it was nothing. And then he's going to bring the wrath and judgment of that Assyrian captivity. Notwithstanding, verse 14, they would not hear. He's doing all this pleading, all this sending prophets and seers and all making all these promises and covenants with the Father, reminding. See, none of that was called for in the law. That's the grace resident in his name. Verse 14, notwithstanding, they would not hear, but hardened their necks like the neck of their fathers that did not believe in the Lord their God. Here we have that hardening concept again. And I'm going to say this again and over again, because I hear a lot of people say God sends people out to be hardened. God never intends his word to go out to harden someone. God sends his word. His intent is always to soften hearts and faith. But if that word is rejected, then they harden up. It's the same sun softens the butter and hardens the clay. God never intends that his word is going to harden someone. He always intends, he's always doing it because it's to soften their hearts and faith. But if they reject it in unbelief, then they harden. It gets hardened. And it can be said they harden it themselves because they're not receiving and believing it. And it could be said God's hardening it because he's the one sending the word that they're not believing. But that's not God's intention. God never intends. He never sets someone else to be hardened. He always gives the option of softening. One of the classic examples of this is in when Paul's in Ephesus. I think, what is it, Acts 17 or 19? I forget now. Acts 17 or 19. He goes to Ephesus. He goes to the synagogue first, and he goes to the synagogue for 3 months, pleading and talking and persuading the Jews in the synagogue. And after 3 months, during that 3 months, they just get harder and harder and harder and harder. So you know what he does? He just decides to leave because it's an act of mercy. You can count on the fact God didn't send Paul into that synagogue to harden their hearts. He was in there trying to soften their hearts with faith, but because they rejected it, their hearts hardened. And it's an act of mercy. Paul leaves because if he stays, it'll just make him harder. God does the same thing in the Old Testament, the 400 years of silence here. That 400 years of silence is an act of mercy. He goes back to his place and he doesn't interact with them, because every time he interacts with them, instead of softening their hearts in faith, it just hardens them more and more and more. So he just goes back, I'm going to stop interacting because it's just going to make it worse for them. It's going to make them even more rebellious. And he goes back to his place. And so we see hints of this hardening concept here. Verse 15, they rejected his statutes and his covenant, and he made with his fathers and his testimonies that he testified against him. And verse 16, and they left all the commandments of the Lord their God and made them molten images. We're back. Here's the two calves. That's what Jeroboam, way back here, when the nation started dividing at the end of Solomon's reign and on into his children. Now 300 years have gone by, and here we are. They're still got these molten calves, and they're still worshiping idols. And he says here, and verse 16, made a grove, worshipped all the host of heaven, and served Baal. They caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire, child sacrifice, used divination and enchantments, those are prohibited by the law, sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoke him to anger. There you have the next course of punishment. Provoke him to anger. That's the next course of punishment. He's working his way through here. Second, third, and they're in the fourth one now. He's going through their history. Each one, provoke him to anger. That's another course of punishment. Therefore, verse 18, God was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah. That's the southern kingdom. So he's going to, because of all this history in here, when he was dispensing the grace resident in his Jehovah name, but instead of responding in faith and returning to the Lord, repenting and returning to the Lord, they instead responded in unbelief and went deeper and further into their rebelliousness and idolatry. And so that sets up the point for this fury of his wrath with the Assyrian captivity that carries them off and removes them as a nation. Again, he didn't remove all the people, but he destroyed the nation. There's no functioning nation there anymore. Let's go down to verse 19. So let's see what happens here. So now he's going to deal with Israel, the northern kingdom, Ephraim, Samaria, the northern kingdom, but he's going to give a hint of what's going to happen to the southern kingdom. Look at verse 19. And Judah kept not the commandments of the Lord. Now we're in the southern kingdom. Look what Judah does, but walked after the statutes of Israel. So Judah, Israel, the northern kingdom, not only destroyed themselves, their idolatry and rebelliousness seeped into Judah, and Judah was following them and becoming rebellious and idolatrous like them. Verse 20, and the Lord rejected all the seed of Israel. So now there, Israel, I think, refers to the whole nation, not just the northern kingdom. Israel, then the northern, Samaria, Ephraim, and Judah, and afflicted them and delivered them into the hand of the spoilers. So the northern kingdom, the hand of the spoilers is Assyria. The southern kingdom, the hand of the spoilers is Babylon. And they're going to be removed. The nation is going to be disintegrated. They're going to remove the people that controlled the nation. verse 21. For he rent Israel from the house of David. Now he's actually going back to the when this all happened. He rent the nation. He rent Israel from the house of David. That's Judah. And they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat the king. And Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made a great sin. For all the children of Israel walked in sins of Jeroboam, which he did. They departed not from them. And then again, he reiterates, until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said, by all the servants of the prophets. So was Israel carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day. And here we are at the Assyrian captivity of the northern kingdom, Samaria. Why are we talking about this? Because we're in Samaria in John 4. But here's where the interesting thing happens. This is where most people go when they want to deal with the Samaritans in John 4. This is the passage most people go. So let's keep reading here. The king of Assyria, verse 24, this is 2 Kings 17, verse 24, and the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and Cuthan and Ava and Hamath and Sepharvaim and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. So Assyria took away all the leaders, all the talent, all the businessmen, all the people that had some kind of a talent of some kind. They've all gone. They've been carried off. The nation is rulerless now, and so Assyria brings in rulers to rule in their stead from other Gentile nations. And these Gentile nations have seven gods. Two of them evidently had two gods. And they bring in these foreign gods and these foreign worship. But it's important to realize these Gentiles are the leadership. They're the aristocracy. They're going to rule the Samaria region because Assyria took off all the Jewish rulers, Israel's rulers. They've carried them all off, and these Gentiles from distant lands are brought in now to rule Samaria in Assyria's stead, according to what Assyria wants. They're kind of they're going to be doing Assyria's job. Then let's look at verse 25. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling that they feared not the Lord. Here, a bunch of Gentiles, they brought their foreign gods, and they were worshiping the way they always had. So God, the Lord, sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Wherefore, they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of God of the land. Therefore, he hath sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them, because they know not the manner of the God of the land. So they come in, Assyria puts in these Gentile rulers with their foreign gods and foreign worship, and they're just going to carry on their normal routine, the Lord sends lions and attacks them, and they run back to Assyria, and this is what Assyria arranges to do. Verse 27, then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry there one of the priests. So here's another group they took out of the land. They took the priest. Obviously, the priest, I would imagine the priest could read and write. They had some function. They had something they could contribute. So that was some of the people that went, that they carried off. And they sent back one of the priests and let him teach of the manner of God of the land. Verse 28. Then one of the priests whom they carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. And here's the verse we want. This is what we've been building to for the past 15 minutes. Go to verse 29. With all this history now, we know basically the division. Fast forward 300 years, we're at the Assyrian captivity. Assyria removes the leadership of Israel and sends them out to the Gentiles and brings Gentiles in to lead and rule Samaria in Assyria's stead. And now look at verse 29. Howbeit, every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses and the high places which the Samaritans had made. every nation in the cities wherein they dwelt. And so we're just going to stop there. But there we have Samaritans. And usually, Bible commentators will come and do a concordance search. And they see Samaritans here and the Samaritans in John 4. And they think they're the same group. But they're not the same group. And the Samaritans here, by the context, the Samaritans here are those Gentile rulers they brought in the land that live in Samaria. So they're Samaritans, but they're not the Samaritans of John 4. These are Gentiles worshiping false gods. And even when they're introduced to the Lord of Israel, the Lord God of Israel, they just mix them in with their own worship, syncretism, and do that. But that's not the Samaritans in John 4. That is not the Samaritans in John 4. So let's take a look at this now. And fast forward 300 years, about 300 years. Fast forward, and the Assyrians carried away the useful part of the population, resettled the land with people from five Gentile nations and their gods, leading to combined worships, syncretistic worship. These were Samaritans. They weren't the Samaritans of John 4. This is not the same group of people. The Samaritans in 2 Corinthians 17 are those Gentile rulers they brought in the land to rule the land in in Assyria's stead. That's not the Samaritans in John 4. We got to make this distinction because it'll change the way we look at the Samaritans in John 4. Most people now, to differentiate this distinction, we'll call the Samaritans in 2 Corinthians 17 Samaritans because they live in Samaria. And the Samaritans of John 4 is a different group that didn't even come on the scene for hundreds of years down the road. What's in John 4 is not what's in 2 Corinthians, is not the same group in 2 Corinthians. The Samaritans of 2 Kings 17 are not the Samaritans of John 4. The latter, the Samaritans of John 4, were members of the Samaritan sect. At that time, Samaria referred primarily to an Assyrian province, not an Israelite city. The Samaritans in John 4 are part of what considered themselves a Jewish sect. And we'll look at that a little more closely. They are not the Samaritans of 2 Kings 17 that were the Gentile idol-worshipping people come in to rule the nation in Assyria's stead. Even though our King James and the Bible translators here have translated the same way. So these are Samaritans, are not the same. To prevent confusion, what most people do now is the people of Samaria refer to as Samaritans, and the people Jesus is talking to is the Samaritans. The ones mentioned in 2 Kings 17, the ones mentioned in John 4, the Samaritans that Jesus is talking to in John 4, are not the Samaritans referred to in 2 Kings 17. Two different groups. So we're going to look at it that way and just kind of give an example. Everyone in Chicago is a Chicagoan, but not all Chicagoans, and I made up this word, are Chicagoitans, members of the Chicago Bible Church. It's a separate group. All Samaritans are Samaritans, but not all Samaritans are Samaritans. And if I haven't confused you enough, I'll try to do more as we go through here. 722 B.C., the days of Jesus, in Jesus' day, everyone in what was the northern kingdom, that's Samaria, they were called Samaritans, like Chicagoans, because they lived in Chicago, because they live in Samaria. Everyone in Samaria is a Samaritan. The Samaritans, there were those who worshipped Israel's true God as members of a sect of Judaism called the Samaritans. This is not the group that they're talking about in 2 Kings Kings 17, that these Samaritans didn't come along for hundreds of years, as we'll see. The Samaritans in John 4 are not those of 2 Kings 17. There's a big difference. The Samaritans referred to anyone living in the province of Samaria. Samaritans in John 4 refer to a subgroup of the Samaritans. They lived in Samaria. They were Samaritans, but they were also a certain religious affiliation. They were a Jewish sect that went by the name Samaritans. It's important to see that because it'll take away some of the folklore, I guess, that most people say is going on in John 4. The Samaritans were Samaritans who belonged to this sect of Judaism. The Samaritans included those spoken in 2 Kings 17, mostly Gentiles who were resettled into the geopolitical area, land of Samaria, at the Assyrian captivity to rule on Assyria's behalf. And they were inhabitants of the north, those Gentile rulers, idol-worshipping, false god worshippers. The Samaritans in John 4 were a close-knit group, a religious group, with minimal intermarriage with Gentiles. That's one of the myths that a lot of commentators suggest because of 2 Kings 17. They think these are Jews who intermarried with the Gentiles. That's not the case. The Samaritans were a very strict sect of Judaism. They considered themselves, anyway, a very strict sect of Judaism, and for the most part did not intermarry. Can we rule out the chance that some teenager was playing Romeo and Juliet and ran off with a Gentile girl or guy? No, we can't say that never happened. But as a sect, as a whole, they did not intermarry with the Gentiles. They stayed loyal to the one true God of Israel. And when you hear the Samaritan woman talk, you see this as we go through it. The Samaritans in John 4 were not some kind of a half-breed sect or a half-breed group, and therefore the Jews hated them. That's just folklore. These were a sect that made up, that came from those people left in the land, and some who had returned to the land just on their own after all this happened, and lived in Samaria, and they formed this Jewish sect that goes all the way back, at least they say it went all the way back to Jacob and Joseph. And that's what the Samaritans are. They're not some half-breed result from going all the way back to 2 Kings 17, worshiping false gods, marrying Gentiles. That is not what the Samaritans are in John 4. The Samaritans in John 4 were a close-knit group, religious group. They had minimal intermarriage with Gentiles. They remained loyal to the one true God of Israel, although they worshipped him at Mount Gerizim rather than Jerusalem. And therefore, they only used the 5 books of Moses. They had what is called that Samaritan Pentateuch. Now, why did they only use the 5 books of Moses? Because the rest of the books of the Old Testament, what did they say? They insisted that Jerusalem was the right place to worship. So they just got rid of those. But they did adhere closely to the 5 books of Moses. They remained, at least in their conception, loyal to the one true God of Israel. There wasn't excessive intermarriage between them and the Gentiles. They remained a Jew. They considered themselves a Jewish sect in the line of Jacob and Joseph, and they were they grew out of the people who were left in the land when Assyria took the rest of the people away. They formed this group hundreds of years after the incident in 2 Kings and Corinthians, I guess, sounds the same. 2 Kings 17, we just read, the Samaritans there, they are those secular leaders, Gentile leaders, worshiping false, bringing their false gods and false worship system that ruled the land in Assyria's stead. That's not the Samaritans in John 4. The Samaritans in John 4 didn't come along till hundreds of years later. begin. They began obscurely around the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. We're not going to go back to that book and look at that. But remember when Ezra and Nehemiah, that's the after the Babylonian captivity, Persia allowed a small amount to return to Judah to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and to rebuild the temple. And some from the northern kingdom, from Samaria, came down and wanted to help them. And Ezra rejected it for various reasons. And they went back, and that began the Samaritan division of John, of the Samaritans in John 4, not the division back with Jeroboam or Rehoboam or 2 Kings 17. The division with this newly formed group, the Samaritans, began in the time of Ezra after the Babylonian captivity. And that's what set in motion. You get your first peek at the Samaritans of John 4 at that time, about 450 BC, which is about 300 years after 2 Kings 17. And they're going to, in 400 BC roughly, they build their own temple, and it's clearly visible and identified in Sener and Shechem about 300 to 200 BC. The Samaritans were pure descendants of Israelites who remained in the land. The schism between Judean Israelites and Samaritan Israelites began to appear in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. We just talked about that. In about 250 to 150 BC, the Samaritan Pentateuch was developed. They rejected the rest of the books of the Old Testament because they insisted Jerusalem was the place of worship, and they were worshiping in Gerizim. And then here's where the main division, this is the problem, and we'll stop with this. When she's talking about this division between the Jews and the Samaritans, this is what she's talking about. About 120 BC, a Judean named Hyrcanus destroyed the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim, devastatingly attacking the Samaritan population, forcing them under Judean control in the days just prior to Jesus. And that's what drove a huge wedge between Israelite Samaritans and Israelite Judeans. It was that destruction of the temple shortly before the arrival of Christ. That's the division. When she's talking about that we don't have no dealings, it's because of that division and what happened there. The Samaritans as a whole were a closely knit religious group. They took it all the way back to the patriarchs, Jacob and Joseph and Ephraim, and they went all the way back there. And they were strictly adherents of the of Moses's five books, the Book of Law, and they considered themselves at least a strict Jewish Israelite sect. And so with that background, now when we go to the encounter in John 4, hopefully that will shed a little light on the interaction there. So let's close with a word of prayer.